Welcome to the Life and Legacy Show, where we discuss all things elder law, estate, and legacy planning. Hosted by certified elder law attorney Tim Seckler from the Seckler Law Firm. And now your host, attorney Tim Seckler.
Hey, and welcome to this week's edition of the Life and Legacy Show, sponsored by the Seckler Law Firm, where great families make great plans. My name is attorney Tim Seckler. I am your host on the show each and every week, where we try to give you the information you need in order to make great estate planning decisions. I think that educated decisions are the best decisions. And so often we see people making estate planning decisions based on the easy route or the simplest route and not really becoming educated on what their options are and what would be in the best interest of themselves, their family, their money, et cetera. So if you're new to the radio show, we do this each and every week. We play it live on the radio on Word FM in Pittsburgh every Saturday morning. And we also have it on a podcast. So if you want to check out the episode on the podcast, you can go to Apple or Spotify. It's called The Life and Legacy Show, and you will find it there. And often what we talk about on the show here is legal planning to deal with long-term care costs, taxes, probate avoidance, and all those issues. Today I want to talk to you about something that I'm not sure we've ever done a show on this, and it's end-of-life decision-making. Not fun to think about, not fun really to prepare for, but I was recently asked by a local healthcare organization to do a talk on end-of-life decision-making and patients' goals of care conversation and how does this whole thing work. And when I got into the information and started preparing for the talk, I took a bit of a deeper dive than I usually have with this. And I found it interesting, and I thought maybe we could talk about it on the radio show. So before I get into the subject matter, what I want you to know is that this radio show is not legal advice. This is for your information, for your education, but not meant to be legal advice. Please don't make any decisions based on what you hear on our radio show or any other radio show. This is to get the wheels turning. This is to get you thinking about it. If you need legal advice, you need to reach out and hire a lawyer for that advice, okay? So let's talk about the scenario that we're talking about here, and that is end-of-life decision-making. And the most famous case where, the sort of landscape shifted and new laws were written and things changed was a very famous case, and it was the case of Terry Schiavo. And so you probably remember the name, but it's been a while. So let's review this situation. Terry Schiavo was 26 years old in 1990 when she went into cardiac arrest. So she has a heart attack, there's brain damage due to lack of oxygen to the brain, and she's essentially left more or less comatose. After a couple of months with no improvement, the doctors went on and did physical therapy and tried to do occupational therapy and trying to get her to a state of awareness without much success. So that the original illness or injury occurred in 1990. By 1998, so 8 years later, her husband wanted to have the tube feed removed. It was his opinion, at least what he purported to say, was that Terry wouldn't want to live this way, and so we need to remove the feeding tube. The parents objected to that decision and made all kind of accusations against him. They appealed it. I think there were 14 different types of appeals in this legal case. And, you know, everybody had an opinion. The talking heads had an opinion. The legal community was looking at it from a constitutional standpoint. The president weighed in. Congress weighed in. The Pope weighed in. And everybody was talking about what do we do about Terry. And the most troubling thing about it is Terry's eyes were open, Terry moved, and so there was a lot of litigation and arguments about whether she was actually in a vegetative state, and there was medical analysis done. And this whole mess went on for years. So they removed the feeding tube in the first time in 2001, and about that time, Jeb Bush, and as Florida governor, they pushed through a law that required the care facility to reconnect the feeding tube. So now she's back to the status quo for a long time until ultimately 3 or 4 years later, she ends up finally they pull the feeding tube again in March of 2005, and that's when she died. And so from 1990 to 2005, over the course of 15 years, She was in a vegetative state, pursuant to, you know, some people's awareness or explanation of the thing. 7 or 8 years in litigation over what to do with Terry. The husband wanted essentially to remove life supporting treatment. The family wanted to leave the life supporting treatment. There were accusations on both sides about monetary interests. Apparently, the husband had a child with another woman while still married to Terry when she was in this state. And the accusation from the family was, you need to just divorce her, but the only reason you're not divorcing her is because there's financial interest resulting from her injury, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this thing got really ugly. But if we want to get rid of the ugliness for a bit of the financial accusations and all that, and just really focus to what happened in what did the people want? The husband wanted to end life support. And in his opinion, the things that he said was that Terry wouldn't want to live this way. His opinion was Terry wouldn't want this. The family, their opinion was Terry would want to remain with the treatment. And so that was the argument. And here's the real challenge to the entire thing. At the end of the day, nobody really knows what Terry wanted. Nobody knows. They didn't know then. You know, Terry was 26 years old. She wasn't thinking about end-of-life decisions. She never did a living will. She never expressed her desires for how to be treated if she was in a comatose state, et cetera. And so what I thought we would do is take a little bit of time and work through this on how this would play out and the importance of doing planning. So like everywhere else, the state of Pennsylvania has a rule book for you. If you don't make your own rules, if you don't do an estate plan, the state of Pennsylvania has a rule book for you on how certain things would unfold when life throws you a curveball. Your question in considering maybe doing some estate planning is whether you agree with what the state's rule book says. And here's what the state's rule book says. If the person is found by the attending physician to be incompetent, which essentially means they've been informed of the medical decisions, they either don't understand them, they cannot communicate their goals or desires. If they are incompetent with regard to their own healthcare decisions, that's the first determination that a medical attending physician needs to establish, is the person doesn't understand what's going on. And then they need to establish, well, okay, so if the person, let's say Tim, if Tim can't communicate his own desires, now where do I turn next? And so then that question becomes, well, did Tim appoint anyone? Typically done with a thing called a medical power of attorney or a healthcare power of attorney. You can appoint somebody to make your healthcare decisions. Now, if you don't have a healthcare power of attorney, if you have not done the document, then the doctor is to turn to family members, if there are any and if we can find them. First would be the spouse. So if it's a spouse, they are the primary decision maker. Unless there are divorce proceedings in place, once the divorce action is filed, they lose their ability to make the decisions. And another scenario where the spouse may not be the sole decision maker is a situation where there are the sick person has adult children, and the spouse is not the parent of the adult children. So if I have kids to spouse A, we go through a divorce, now I'm married to spouse B. If I get sick, spouse B has a vote, but so do my children from the first relationship. They're on the same level, so to speak. Next up, if there is no spouse, would be kids, then parents, then siblings, then grandchildren, then essentially any adult who purports to have a knowledge of what Tim would want could stand in next. And so that's sort of the way that the process unfolds. Now, the question is, well, what happens if I've got two kids and I have not made my wishes known? Well, the doctor is supposed to follow the majority decision. Well, what happens if we don't agree? Well, the doctor is not supposed to withhold any medical treatment. We continue to treat as per standard until the siblings resolve their dispute. And eventually this thing may end up in a court system through a guardianship proceeding or whatnot. But that's kind of, in my opinion, the system to avoid, because yeah, I might want it to be my spouse, but I might not want it to be my spouse. Or if I am in a second marriage type situation, I've got a spouse and I've got a kid to a different relationship, maybe I want to appoint one person so that there's no debate. If I have two children, I probably want to appoint one person. You know, and that's just sort of a practice tip in our office. When we're doing these types of documents and people want to name both kids, I attempt at least. I mean, of course, these are my clients' documents. They can do what they want. But we attempt to talk our clients out of doing joint agents, because what happens when they don't agree? Now we're in a place where essentially we've lost control. We can't make a decision because they disagree. And loss of control was the reason we did the document in the first place. So let's not set it up in a fashion where we can lose control. So that's that's that. Now let's talk about, and this is the type of stuff that we work with our clients on, right? So when you go through our process, we talk about wills, we talk about trusts, we talk about powers of attorney. I'm not sure I've ever done a full episode on healthcare decision making, but it's just as important as where does the money go, right? And so these are the types of things that we talk to our clients about in our estate planning workshops. So if you come to one of our workshops, we do a series of classes teaching you the things that you need to know in order to make great estate plans. So we'll teach you the difference between wills and powers of attorney and trust, revocable trust and irrevocable trust. We talk about the long-term care system, Medicare versus Medicaid. We give you through this series of classes all the information you would need in order to make good estate planning decisions. And then we work with you to do that in a very cost-efficient manner. Like, we've got this really interesting workflow that is sort of classroom-based, because my opinion, you know, if you have a simple will, let's say that somebody listening to this radio show today has a simple will that they did some time ago. If you have a will, odds are you really probably don't understand your other options. You know, somebody told you, hey, you're not rich, all you need is a will, and so that's what you got. But maybe there are other reasons we should consider some other documents other than just I'm rich. Like I want to protect my house from the nursing home, or avoid probate, or be easy on the kids, or whatever the case is. So anyway, that's the type of stuff that we teach you in our workshops, which you can find anytime at seclerlawfirm.com, S-E-C-H-L-E-R, lawfirm.com. My name is Tim Seckler, and I was not all that creative with the name of my law firm. So go to seclerlawfirm.com and come to one of our workshops. They're free. You'll like it. We'll teach you a lot of good stuff. Okay, so let's get back to this. Now, the document that we do here is a sort of a horse by many colors, and what I mean is people call this thing different things. Okay, so let's just get some terminology correct. There is a document called a power of attorney. Now, when people use the term power of attorney, they're typically referring to a financial and legal document, a durable power of attorney, probably, where I'm naming somebody to make legal and financial decisions on my behalf. You can also do a healthcare power of attorney. And often in our office, always, we do this in a separate document, because we may want one child to make the financial decisions. We may not want another child to make the healthcare decisions. Or maybe I just don't want my bank to see my healthcare information. I don't want my hospital to see my bank information. So it's a separate document. So when I ask somebody if they have done a power of attorney and they say, yes, I need to clarify, is it a healthcare? Is it financial? And then there's another document that is commonly referred to as the living will. So a living will is not the same thing as a will, right? So some people come to us and they'll say, well, I already did a living will and my kid's my executor and it's equal shares to the kids. That's not a living will. I don't know why lawyers didn't get more creative with the name of these documents, but that's just what it is. So a will, a last will and testament, is a document that deals with the disposition of your estate when you pass. A living will is a set of instructions on how you would want to be treated while you're alive. And so a living will typically governs two situations. It governs a situation where you have an end-stage medical condition. That's a condition that is going to result in your death despite medical treatment. So this is not like a do not resuscitate order or a physician's order for life-sustaining treatment. Those are different documents. A living will is a document that is typically signed by healthy people thinking about what would happen if I later had a diagnosis or an illness. And the situation is two situations, an end-stage medical condition or an irreversible coma. And in the living will, you'll say, if I'm in either of those two situations and the doctor certifies in writing that I'm in an end-stage medical condition or an irreversible coma, then all of the following instructions apply. I don't want tube feeds. I don't want mechanical ventilator. I don't want chemotherapy. I don't want all of these things. Okay, so that's done in a document called a living will. Now, some years ago, the state legislature saw fit to pass some legislation, and now they have a form in the rule books where it's a combined form. It's called an advance directive, which is the most common way to do this. An advance directive is a combination of part one, a healthcare power of attorney, naming somebody to make the decisions, and part two, the living will, what to do if I become incapacitated. Here's what I'll say about the living will. I think the most important question on a lot of the forms, including the form that we use in our office, we give you the ability to select that your agent shall use these instructions, or alternatively, your agent may use these instructions as guidance but could override your desires. Okay, so shall versus may. My agent shall follow these decisions, these instructions, or my agent may override. And I want to tell you a quick story. I don't think you'd probably mind. And in 2020, I had a family member who got really sick with COVID. And this was back in a time period where they didn't understand treatment of COVID the way that they understand treatment of COVID now. And he was super sick, and he ends up in an intensive care unit. And while in the ICU, he was on heavy oxygen, you know, tubes supplying oxygen through his nose. And it was conversation about whether he was going to go on a mechanical ventilator. The next step would be a breathing machine. And he had a living will that said that he did not want to have a mechanical ventilation. Now, remember, though, there would have to first be a determination for that instruction to apply that he was in an end-stage medical condition. When you do this living will document, it's not that I would never want mechanical ventilation. It's that I would not want mechanical ventilation if I were an end-stage medical situation, meaning they're going to give me treatment, but I'm going to essentially die anyway, right? Or if I'm in an irreversible coma. So here's a conversation with the hospital about whether we're going to use a ventilator. And you know, the family made it very clear that we did not consider him to be in an end-stage medical condition, and therefore the living will doesn't apply. If he needs a ventilator, you put him on the ventilator. And we had those conversations with the doctor, and we had the conversations with the social worker, and we made sure that they put it in a medical record and all the rest, because we wanted to be real clear. If he needs the treatment, you're going to give him the treatment, all right? Which gets me to sort of a practice point in our office and maybe something for you to consider is I've become a fan of saying that my agent may use these instructions as guidance but can override my desire. And the reason for that, I think, from a very practical matter, is that my agent, sort of by definition, is going to have better information to make those healthcare decisions than I have today when I sign this document. It could be 15 years from now. I don't know what the issue is going to be. And so you appoint the decision maker. You give them an indication of what you want. But if things are a little gray, you ultimately give the discretion to the decision maker. Okay? Now, that's the advance directive that deals with end-of-life decision-making, healthcare decision-making. That person that you name, your healthcare agent, also makes decisions with regard to admissions to long-term care facilities, hospitalization, et cetera. There's another document that you should know about. Like, a lot of people use the word do not resuscitate order. So that's a thing that people talk about. Now, there is still in the law in Pennsylvania do not resuscitate orders. But several years back, they sort of changed the law. And they created this thing called a physician order for life-sustaining treatment. So there was a lot of attention being paid to end-of-life decision-making, and they passed a law for a physician's order for life-sustaining treatment. And this form is used typically after a diagnosis, generally after admission to some sort of a healthcare setting. It could be hospice care. It could be a nursing home. It could be any type of care where there's a doctor involved. And the doctor needs to sign the order, so the physician's order for life-sustaining treatment. This is not a document you do in a law office like mine, where you sign your own document when you're healthy and thinking about what happens if I get sick later. With a pulsed form, with a physician order for life-sustaining treatment, you are sick. You already have whatever the issue is that we're talking about. And then that document deals with, okay, now now we're in a different level. Now we're in a different place. And so this document goes a little bit deeper than just declaring an end-stage medical condition. So with this document, you can get into, okay, I have an end-stage, you know, I have a pulsed form, and I'm contemplating what would happen as a result of if I passed away from a disease like, say, cancer. But then what happens, I'm dealing with cancer is like the major issue. But if while I'm dealing with cancer or some other disease, what happens if I get pneumonia? Do we treat the pneumonia? And you can indicate in this form whether you would want to go to the hospital to treat the pneumonia. You can indicate in the form whether you would not. You want more comfort measures, right? So the physician order for life-sustaining treatment is a document that's done later. Now, if the person does not have capacity, the healthcare decision maker, be it the representative, because there was no healthcare power of attorney ever done, or the agent, if there was a healthcare power of attorney, that person can communicate with the doctor as a surrogate decision maker to help the doctor understand the pulsed form. So that's a very, very common form, and one that you should probably know about. Now, the pulsed form is one that we use, again, after somebody is sick. It's not one. If you're listening to this radio show just thinking about, well, I should probably do some long-term care planning. I should probably talk about my goals of care with somebody. That's probably more in line with the living will than it is the pulsed form. Now, I do want to share one additional document that we came up with in our office, and that is a healthcare decision document that is not necessarily end of life. So we do a document, I mentioned a little bit ago, that when we work with our clients, we do it through a series of classes. We, you know, there's the 100 level course, and then there's the 200 level course, and you decide if you want to hire our law firm. And once you start working with our law firm, we have these other classes that we have you go through, and one of which is on goals of care, healthcare decision making, and we have a document that is called All About You, or I guess it's technically called All About Me. And what you do with this document is you indicate your care preferences way prior to this end of life stuff. And so, you know, if I've got dementia later, people can live with dementia for a long time. That is not necessarily an end stage medical condition in the short term. So if I'm going to be, you know, if I don't really understand who I am and where I am and all those things, it's been my experience that people still can derive some enjoyment out of life. And so for me, like, I'm an outdoorsman. I like to fish. I like to hunt. I like to hike. I like to ski. I like to camp. I like to do it outside. If there's things that I can do outside, I want to be outside. And so if later when I have dementia, there are people caring for me that don't know me any differently than they know the guy in the next room, well, you know, maybe in this form I can say, you probably want to hand me an Outdoor Life magazine. If you hand me the Outdoor Life magazine and I can look at the pictures of the elk and the fish and the deer and the whatever, it's probably going to bring a little bit of joy to my life. And then you can also put in your religious preferences, and you can put in the foods that you love, and you can put in the foods that if you put it on my plate, it's going to tick me off. I don't want to eat a pickle. I don't like pickles. I don't know why every restaurant in America, when you order a sandwich, wants to force a pickle down your throat. I don't want the pickle. You should ask before you rub my sandwich on all that pickle juice, right? And so but if I am in a long-term care setting later, maybe the people around me, like my kids and my wife, know I don't like pickles, right? The one kid steals them. But if I'm in a long-term care facility, maybe it's important for the people around me to know my food preferences and my hygiene preferences. And because, you know, how often do we do the end-of-life decision? Well, once, right? We do the end of life decision once, and we got this legal document setting the rules for that. But how often do we brush our teeth? And how often do we eat? And how often do we shower? And how often do we need religious services? And how often do we need to visit with family? And how often do we do these other things? And so our goals and our objectives in the care setting prior to the end of life, I think, is very important from a standard of life. You know, one of our philosophies around here is that life planning is more important than death planning. And I can't prevent my need for care. If I'm going to get sick, I'm going to get sick, right? I hope to live a long time. And if I live a long time, I'm probably eventually going to get sick. So I can't prevent having health issues at all. I can prevent some of them, I suppose. But what I can do is I can understand how I would like to receive my treatment. If you want to stay home as long as possible, tell somebody. If you want to go to a care setting and not be a burden on the kids, tell somebody. If you're in the care setting and you're being cared for by other people, tell them about yourself, but you got to do it now because you're not going to know how to do it later. A lot of these health issues impacting seniors impact your cognition. You're not going to be able to do it later. And so we have our clients go through a document, and you end up creating this document. It's all about me. And I have to imagine that these documents, if it ends up at the in the medical record at the personal care home, that that has an impact on how this stranger is taking care of me, and I think that that matters. And so those are my thoughts today on healthcare decision-making and how you can set this thing up appropriately. And I hope you learned something. I hope you found this show valuable, and I hope to see you at one of our upcoming estate planning and asset protection workshops. Go to seclerlawfirm.com, S-E-C-H-L-E-R, lawfirm.com. Register for one of our workshops. We'd love to meet you there. And remember, folks, that this show is for your education. It's for your information. It is not intended to be legal advice, so don't make any decisions with regard to this stuff without seeking some legal counsel first. We're here anytime. Go to seclerlawfirm.com, S-E-C-H-L-E-R, lawfirm.com. We'd love to meet you. So thanks. Have a great week.
This has been the Life and Legacy Show, sponsored by the Seclar Law Firm, where great families make great plans. SeclarLawFirm.com or call 724-841-1393.